Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Aparuta De Sangamatasa Taura Ye Sodavanta Bamunjantu Sadang. So this is the beginning of the formal retreat, and we've made these taking dependence, this way of making a commitment to practice, Dhamma practice. And this retreat, see it in terms of opportunity that we have this time, the conditions, just mentally note the conditions that are supporting this occasion. We've got, you know, very good conditions, and we've got a good support team, lay people who've come and offered to help and allow us, the monastic community, to dedicate ourselves to Dhamma practice without a lot of duties and responsibilities. Then the conditions of, we have a nice temple to use, grounds, situation that is all very helpful and conducive towards the development of mindfulness. So that we can kind of rest in this, a sense of being at ease and relaxed. And it's not like being out in the jungle. Survival of the fittest, or the dangers lurking behind the bushes. Even though this can happen, yet basically, on this planet Earth, at this time is relatively, supportive environment. During the past few weeks, we've had a very relaxed time and been able to enjoy a few of the pleasures that we don't usually allow ourselves, and a sense of ease and goodwill, good fellowship, and so forth. These are all conducive towards meditation. And just to look at your own, contemplate your own way you use the word meditation. What does that mean? And what does that, how do you respond to that word? Because like any words that we use, we oftentimes have very fixed views. And so some people see meditation in just very formal kind of ways of sitting, the sitting practice, or walking meditation practice. But it really means learning to understand the nature of the mind, kind of mental, regarding our mentality, the experience of consciousness, of sensory impingement of planetary life, and a planetary body, a human body, a sensory body, and consciousness all with us all the time. Now when we think about Dhamma in terms of formal Dhamma teaching, sometimes we forget this. We get abstracted into ideas, you know, our views about Dhamma and definitions and perceptions that we hold, and we sometimes don't trust our own direct awareness and intuitive sense in regards to what's right, obvious, right with us all the time. So we find it, because we're so educated to think and to perceive in cultural patterns, conditions, that we tend to trust views and opinions or ideas, definitions, doctrines, teachings, and all this much more than we trust our own intuitive sense. So during this retreat, an encouragement to learning to trust your own intuitive intelligence, which you can't define it, you can't find it as something that, you know, that you can see as an object. You can't perceive it. It's the simple act of being, aware. And then, how do you be aware? And we have to describe how to be aware, but it's not, with all the descriptions and clever ways of expressing views about awareness, that still's not it, is it? It's your own willingness and to trust in a direct knowing. The present, the Pachubana Dhamma, here and now, the way it is. During this retreat, also the word retreat it brings up various perceptions of meditation. Retreat means, you know, absolute silence, control of everything, trying to, you know, keep all the noisy things out and really develop samadhi and got to get something. You've got 3 months now to really get something and you've got to practice hard. You've got to really, work hard at your meditation. That's one way of looking at it. Seeing that as more like an ordeal that you're engaged in, which you have to really tough it out in some way and control everything. Try to keep anything that is worldly, annoying, tempting, obnoxious, disgusting, or unwanted away. So that's the control mode of, like, retreat. That's how we used to give them, in fact. Remember, 10 years ago or so, I gave, one of the last retreats I gave with this really hardline theme, was a disaster. Because, I was impressed by how willing people were committed to doing it, but at the end of the day, I didn't find much wisdom coming out of it for anyone, because it's more like just forcing yourself, making yourself do something, enormous efforts and discipline and so forth that went into it, but the result was not very good. And so then the word winter retreat became almost, for some people, like, oh my God, another winter retreat. And just the word winter retreat became you start contracting with fear. You think, I don't know if I can take another winter retreat. Because that's the, your experience is the total misery that is relieved at the end of it. You, you do get a good sense of relief, like hitting your head on a brick wall. You know, it's so nice with the feeling that when you stop hitting your head, it feels good. But is that the way? Is that, you know, is that a skillful way to live our lives? Then the idea of trusting yourself, this I've been emphasizing over and over, because I realize that that's the thing that we most lack, is because of the because most of us come from very kind of worldly backgrounds or materialistic cultures, and we societies that we see things in a certain way, and we conceive ourselves or perceive ourselves endlessly on in terms of personality or character. We love to have types, you know, identify with the different perceptions used, and many of us see ourselves through our faults. There's a tendency very strongly to see yourself through what you think is wrong with you, to see yourself as weak or not good enough or unworthy or not pure enough or selfish or inadequate in some way. So as long as we operate from these kind of perceptions of self, then of course we can't prove, you know, through strong determination and hard discipline, we can maybe get a kind of more sense of I can take it, I can endure, and I'm better than I think I am. But still the basic delusion is there, the whole attitude of a self. It's never questioned, but only is our basis, our modus operandi for experience. Lungpa Cha used to always describe meditation as a holiday for the heart. And so this is my translation of the Thai, Pakpon Thang Jit Jai. And holiday for the heart. And so but the way I used to hold the meditation when I was in my early days with Lungpa Cha was anything but a holiday. It was an ordeal, you know, to really prove myself, drive myself, force myself. So what does it mean, holiday of the heart? Does it mean this is not a holiday? This is so then a holiday or whatever is a, you know, as I say, when we think of the word holiday, it's a resting, a relaxing. Pakporn in Thai, you like to relax, take it easy. A relaxed heart, a sense of being at ease, of trust. And being at ease rather than the hard line of I've got to get something, I've got to get rid of something. I mean, I've got to get samadhi. My samadhi is lousy. I've got to get better samadhi. Or I've got to be more mindful even. I've got to purify myself. I've got too many impurities, and I've got to get rid of the impurities. So even the Dhamma teachings we can hold in a very stiff way that just intimidate us. You know, this sense of I'm impure and I've got to make myself pure through hard work, through discipline, through striving, through struggling, is very much, you know, the way we tend to view our lives. I'm my impurities are me, and because of these impurities, I've got to do something about them to try to make myself pure. Or it is the word enlightenment. Some people don't even like the word. Or liberation, or nibbana, or the words that we use for reality, for ultimate realization, can be, we can feel so separated, so distant from that reality. And especially if you see yourself in that, with that self-view. So, you know, I can't see how I, as a personality, can ever be pure, personally speaking. I can think pure thoughts and hold on to ideals of purity, but then I can't sustain it. Maybe even convince myself I'm purified, but I can't hold it. It's not something that I can rest in, that I can totally trust, just by making myself, by controlling my mind and making myself into what I think is purity. So in this resting, the sense of relaxing, taking it easy for this retreat, doesn't mean that then you think, oh, what do you mean? We're not going to have any discipline. We've got to hold it together. We've got to control. People can't talk. We've got to do something, because the thinking mind then feels that if we lose control, if we just relax, we'll all just sleep through the whole 3 months. Sleep and eat. Because taking it easy sometimes, relaxing, that's what we think is relaxing, is just kind of, lying about, doing whatever we feel like. But there is a form of this retreat, and we've referred in a tradition, with monastic tradition, Dhamma Vinaya, so these are, how do we hold these? You know, are they intimidating perceptions that we use or do we grasp them and conceive them and then personally measure ourselves according to ideals that we get from reading the Dhamma Vinaya? So as long as you keep thinking about it and keep defining yourself with adjectives and so forth, then you're bound to that level of, how do you get beyond it? Because that realm is it just goes around and around. They call it samsara. It just, one thing connects to another, and it just goes around and around until it drives you crazy. So as a person, as a personality, doesn't mean I have no personality, but to what is that which is aware, the awakened state, naturally awakenedness, awareness, intuitive awareness is very natural to us. It's not a state you create through controlling or holding on to anything. So like pakporn tang jitjai or holiday for the heart isn't striving, forcing, controlling, manipulating, holding on. But to me, it's like just an act of trust, of relief, of just letting the burden go. Whatever you think you are, or your views about winter retreat, or Amaravati, or about me, or anyone else, We're not denying or defending any of this, but this is not the point, to keep trying to figure out everything on that level, but to trust in this natural state, an alertness, attentiveness in the present. So like right now, all of us are conscious entities. This is the experience of consciousness. So then consciousness is a natural state. We don't create consciousness. It's natural to this realm, to the state we're in. So it's not a personal, attribute. You say, my consciousness, Ajahn Sumedho's consciousness, things like this. Consciousness has no personal quality. Doesn't belong to anyone, and you can't, you know, it's not red or blue or even Buddhist. Then it's natural to this state we're in. Being born in this realm is the experience of consciousness. And yet we can be conscious and not aware. So, you know, as we get conditioned, then we lose that perspective, our discerning ability to see things as they are, because we create illusions that we hold on to that affect our conscious experience, and then we experience life through those delusions. So, say, on a personal level, if I attach to myself, if I never break down, crack that delusion of I am this body, this person here, then how I interpret everything, all experience, is a highly personal interpretation. Me and mine and what I think and feel and my emotions, my thoughts, my body is the way I interpret conscious experience through this illusion of a self. Then the Buddha encouraged it, said, wake up and see the way it really is. So this sense of awakeness, you know, it isn't dependent on conditions. It's merely we forget it when we get lost in our delusions. And so even though we're all equally conscious, that consciousness easily gets distorted through the way we perceive. And that's why there's so many crazy things in the world, people doing so many horrible things. You hear the news or read the newspapers, and there's endless kind of strife and struggle and fear and corruption and selfishness and stupidity that seems to be everywhere. And people can, you know, you can get really distorted through being just so totally obsessed with some maybe horrible perception. Seeing everything is evil, and then you can get into annihilation. You've got to destroy the world, or what's happening in India and Pakistan right now, just the way, say, one country perceives another. You know, just the thing, seeing the Pakistanis and the Indians through these distorted perceptions. And then that can lead to a nuclear holocaust. Easily, you know, if we just go along with that perception. And we are committed to it. We can justify it. We can prove it. We can give all kinds of justifications for even the most atrocious acts. So you can't trust that, your perceptual conditioning, your way you think and emotional habit. But what can you trust right now, here and now? Is in awareness. This is the only thing to take refuge in. And it's natural. It's not like you know, if you think I've got to get jhanas in order to get it, then you're stuck with that view. You know, I'm somebody that is heedless, without good concentration, and in order to realize nibbana, I've got to get a lot of concentration in order to do vipassana, insight meditation, and that then reinforces this sense of I am somebody who doesn't have something, who's got to get something. And that's the sakkaya ditti, or personality view, that is so convincing and real for most of us. But not that these things are even wrong, you know, the views, or they may even be wrong, or it's just the way we grasp them, out of ignorance, out of lack of awareness, through habit, and through starting always from the self view. I've got to get something I don't have. I've got to get rid of things that I have that are impure. I've got to become enlightened in the future. I've got to practice hard in order to become and attain. So we grasp that, and then what happens? No matter how hard you try, you end up, you know, feeling despair, because it's like, you know, you're trying to get hold of something. And even if you get something, you're going to lose it. You know, so if you gain through discipline and concentration practices some kind of blissful state that seems very pure, because of the basic delusion has never been seen through, then you feel a great sense of loss when the conditions don't support such high levels of concentration. So we can get very, you know, obsessed with controlling, trying to keep out noises and distractions and threatening experiences, because it makes us lose our concentration. It upsets me. I feel shattered and by the disruptive conditions. I just got my samadhi, and then suddenly somebody comes in and says something, and I get really upset. It's their fault then. So then we can blame, you know, the people or the condition. So contemplating or reflecting on this, that starting from an enlightened position of just awareness, rather than thinking of attaining some idealized state of enlightenment, and if we create enlightenment as something we don't have, that we've got to get, then whatever we do, we're trying to attain something we've already preconceived, rather than trusting in the natural state. Our natural state is enlightened. So it's not like asking you to attain something you don't have, or that any of you here are so, you know, don't have it and some do. Because then that's back into that realm again of me and you and quantities, qualities, the conditioned realm. So this is why during this retreat, it's encouragement to trust more. This sadha, or Pali word sata, it's a very simple thing of trusting. And when I say trusting yourself, I don't mean your personality, because your personality can say all kinds of things and go all over the place. So you can't trust your views, opinions, emotions, but what can you trust in this moment? And then, this is this awareness, sense of openness, receptivity. Very simple, very natural. Then you say, well, are you enlightened, Ajahn Sumedho? But that's not the point, is it? That's a pointless question. But in terms of practice, in trusting, this is a natural state of purity, enlightenment, that isn't personal. As soon as I claim it as some kind of personal attainment, that's very misleading. And that it goes back into that mode of I've attained something through my many years of monastic life and practice, and I've achieved and attained something. And then that makes you feel, well, you know, I'm just a new anagarika, and I'm all over the place, and I don't know what. Ajahn Sumedho, well, he's been a monk all these years, over 35 years now, so then you start perceiving yourself as someone, who's impure, who's not enlightened, and maybe perceiving me as somebody who is. But that's not the point, is it? It's the reality is here and now. It's not a personal attainment. It's nothing to do with how many years you've been a monk or a nun or whatever. It's how much trust you put in this moment, to just receive this moment as is, in all its aspects. So like an intuitive moment embraces, you know, it includes everything. When you start thinking, then you divide everything. The thought process is divisive. And that's its very nature. It can't help it. It's just the way thinking operates. You can only have one thought at a time. And then, you know, so you have to think this thought which connects to another. It goes, well, you know, in tandem. So you have, you know, you have one thought moment, another. So when you conceive yourself through thought, through definition, through perception, then you are binding yourself to that limitation of always feeling separate, divided. And that very sense of separation and division is dukkha, is the suffering of the First Noble Truth. Because to feel separate, you know, even just that simple, even when you're feeling good and separate, not when you're feeling depressed and separate, when you're feeling good, even that, if you know, I notice even when I'm happy, there's still, and I'm attached to that kind of happiness, there's something still unsettling about it, unsatisfying. Until I trust again in the awareness of it. So, an intuitive moment, then, here and now, Pachubana Dhamma, is very simple, very natural, that we can only recognize through trust. And that trust is Even if you're all uptight, tense, just open to that. Allow things to be what they are. You know, not even to think, I have to learn how to relax in order to trust. Then you get, it's all complicated again. So if you're all tense, painful, frightened, whatever, and then you assume you've got to make yourself fearless and relaxed, then it becomes complicated, doesn't it? So, allow things to be tense, uptight, frightened is like this. In an embracing it, welcoming sense of allowing things to be, the conditioned realm to be what those conditions are. It's not up to me to try to refine the conditions and manipulate them and control them, but I know I have this sense of that's not it where it's at. I don't have to strive to try to get rid of this or change that or get hold of something. But the sense of relief of patpon tang jitjai, of holiday for the heart. So I'm not just going to fall into heat and fall asleep on the floor or not be able to attend the morning puja or anything. Because I'm so relaxed. The intuitive moment includes the conditions and the conventions that we use. So there's not an attack on tradition or convention or on formal meditation practices or on meditation techniques or anything like that. I'm not putting down jhanas or meditation techniques that you've learned as something that you should just throw them out or they're all a bunch of rubbish. It's learning to trust in what is normal and natural, which allows then the conditions to not dominate our conscious experience. We're not overwhelmed or obsessed with the quality of the conditions that we might be experiencing, because our relationship to them is one of embracing, welcoming, an intuitive acceptance rather than a critical analysis of them. During this retreat also, see, it's like I see my role in this retreat as someone to encourage rather than to teach you. Because this, see me as a teacher, then you might even grasp what I say or whatever, and then you try to meditate according to the Ajahn Sumedho technique or something like that. And that's not what I encourage. It's not a mental state that I want to encourage, because what I'm encouraging you to do is a kind of imminent act of trust. There's a lot of fear in this realm that we live in. This planet Earth and this universe is very frightening to us. So, and being in a community, living with other people, we brings a lot of anxiety or fear into the mind. Recognize that this is a frightening realm in the terms of the conditioned quality of it. Much of it's survival of the fittest, isn't it? It's learning to survive, get by as a creature, get enough food to eat and shelter and protection. We've got here here in Britain, we do. We can take a lot for granted because it's fairly well-run country with conditions and we, you know, we can easily take that our meal every day for granted. And we don't have to go around scrounging for grains of rice just to have an, just to survive for another day, or to appear a lot like wild animals or even bandits or terrorists. A lot of parts of the world are a lot of terrorists. So, but here, this is, so far, we've been saved from that fear. So trusting then allows, is a way to get perspective on fear rather than trying to get rid of it. Or to control everything to make us feel safe, but recognize the ultimate safety is in awareness. And this is, you know, like in terms of people at court, dangerous activities like rock climbers or jumping from parachutes or doing very, you know, doing very dangerous activities. It's quite popular, you know, to court something that is life-threatening. Because in those situations where you're physically challenged to, where you're, it's a matter of being aware or not being aware, you're aware. If your life's in danger, you're physically threatened by something, you know, there's something in it, instinct takes over, and you just, you know, you don't have time to worry about what somebody thinks of you or anything like this. You're just immediately present to be fully with the step where you're going to put your foot next or your hand. Because this, bodies are very damageable, vulnerable things, so they, this is the way it is. This realm, there's, you know, when we think about it a lot, and there's a lot to fear in it. But if we think of ourselves that fear is my problem, then we make it more than that, isn't it? We operate from a basic delusion that I'm frightened rather than fear is like this. Or anxiety or discontentment or whatever. So that why we call it a refuge. In Buddha Dhamma Sangha is the formal sense of refuge. But this really implies boiling it down to awareness is the refuge. In a safe situation, like now, say, retreat mode, say, we don't have a lot of duties and things to occupy us, to keep us busy. Because one way of getting rid of fear is by distracting ourselves in something else. You know, so, you know, boredom or discontentment or despair or whatever, we can distract ourselves by doing something or getting involved in some activity that we can absorb into. But a retreat, like monastic life, its kind of quality is that it gives us a lot of time, space. With nothing to do but sit or walk, stand or walk or lie down, to breathe, to be, you know, there's not, so that these are kind of, these we don't, you know, if we aren't aware, we tend to ignore the basic things that are happening to us by involving ourselves, distracting ourselves in various activities. Or if we give up on that, we just get depressed and We just want to drug ourselves out of existence or just sleep or we can't operate anymore because we don't know how to wake up or trust in anything or in trust in awareness. So during this retreat, this will be my main encouragement. Because that's what I can do, in how I see in terms of my role in this community is encourage that. I can't make you. Because that doesn't work, you know. Be mindful. Command it, or order you to be mindful. Because that gives the wrong message, isn't it? A commanding order intimidates you. You can go back into the self-reaction of, oh God, he's always telling me to be mindful. So it needs to come from encouragement, and to trust. And when you see yourself getting into compulsive habits and fears and meditation habits even, just be, you know, because it's easy to fall back into these habits, just see it also when you catch yourself, when you see suddenly you're operating from willfulness or from obsessive compulsive tendencies. Just welcome that. The attitude is not to even disparage yourself from doing that, but the sense of relaxing and letting it be. Let compulsiveness be compulsive. But your relationship to it then is with awareness and wisdom rather than identity on a personal level. We're all adult people. So, you know, to give the impression to give the impression I'm the wise one and you're the student or you're just the, you know, this kind of teacher-student relationship. Contemplate that. If you see yourself always as my student and I see myself as your teacher, then we get caught in playing that role. And we easily fall into it's easy to, we're used to that. We're always thinking of ourselves as, I'm a teacher or I'm a student and that identity, because that's a conventional way of looking at this scene here. But that's not what I'm encouraging is for you to be my student and I'm your teacher. But to trust in your awareness of the way that you do react when you're put in a conventional role, and I'm in a conventional role. So this encouragement then is getting to the real teacher. In the Hindu, in the Vedanta, they call it the Satguru, or the inner teacher, the wisdom that comes through awareness, trust in that, rather than in the words that I speak, or in what you read in the scriptures. Now, emotionally, we might feel very threatened by such talk. Oh, God, I can't trust anything myself. I'm all over the place. So we're not used to, we're used to the delusions of our society. So it's easier to play the role than to awaken. And as so many of us come into monasticism, we like to play the role. Get identify strongly with our role in the Sangha, with our position, with our seniority, with our duties, with our position, titles. And that's very easy to do because that's how we're conditioned to think and interpret experience. We always see ourselves in terms of monks and nuns, or senior and junior, and lay people, and men and women, and on like this. It gets it's so easy to fall back into that pattern because that's how we're conditioned to think and experience life and interpret our experience. So the trusting then is not a personal refuge. It's not male or female, monk or nun, or lay man or lay woman, or Buddhist or Christian or anything. It's not it has no name, and it's here and now, totally natural, relaxed, trusting. And allowing whatever you're feeling physically or emotionally to be what it is. Rather than judging and trying to change it in some way through some ideal you have. This encouragement to see each other in this way, as a Kalyanamitta, as friends, as human beings that we're all here for the same reason. And our moral agreements on behavior are this way. So we have the precepts and the Vinaya and so forth. So these are conventional agreements in regards to the way we live with each other. in the conventional world. But identity with that also creates enormous division. So, when we identify with these perceptions, then we're back into the samsara again, the realm of suffering. So the convention then is like if you're an anagarika or a lay person, or Siladhara, or Bhikkhu, junior, senior, Mahatera, Telkun, or whatever. These are conventional, merely conventions that are present. Rather than identities that we assume. So in this practice, it's not a matter of how many years and how skilled you are at meditation and whether you're all that, led such a good life or not, but how willing you are, how much trust you can, you can have towards this simple act of awareness. Simplicity of relaxing in the present, opening, receiving life as you experience it, through your senses, through your mind. So then, consciousness is informed through wisdom rather than through ignorance. So the consciousness then, this experience of consciousness is then something that reflects reality rather than something that separate, something that we can claim or divide or measure in any way. So then the word panya, or wisdom, the panya arises from this awareness. The more we trust it, then wisdom is the Satguru that informs our experience, rather than having views and opinions about through reading books about wisdom or having wise teachings that you attach to. So in this way, the common ground is awareness consciousness. Now this is pointing to the way it is. This isn't some abstract idealism that I'm kind of holding up to you, but this is for you to recognize and begin to really appreciate and treasure and value this opportunity of awakening. Of course, emotionally, we're not primed for this. Emotions are conditioned through habits, through extremities. So that one can feel very threatened or very bored or very restless or very negative about, being aware, because the emotional reaction can get very, once you have a level of awareness and peace, and the emotions can start boring, and peace is boring, isn't it? They all cry for peace, peaceniks. We want peace and harmony, and then everything's too peaceful and harmonious. It's boring. You're watching these videos. You don't want to watch a video that's just peaceful and harmonious. Sitting there watching an enlightened monk being totally peaceful. Because, emotionally we like the excitement, the blockbuster, the action man, the romance, the adventure. Excites and stimulates. So, and that's emotionally what we're primed for is that kind of we can refine it, we can develop more refined tastes in the conditioned realm. But generally speaking, we're still left at the end of the day with ignorance and suffering. So trusting in awareness, at first, the more, the thing is, as you begin to appreciate it, recognize, or it's to realize, these words like realize or recognize. It's not that any of you don't have it or you can't get it. It's just learning to recognize, pay attention, reflect on the way it is. So in the morning, I'll do these reflections, these ways of encouraging you to trust and to recognize, realize. Consciousness with awareness. Panya. We have our vipaka kamma also. So, in, you know, this the way we react to things and that are quite individual. You know, so this is these things come up when the conditions arise and this condition appears. You know, so. When those conditions cease, then it disappears. So, recognizing this, we can open with awareness to the karma of this moment, whatever it is, in any personal way. Like if I go and ask each one of you how you feel right now, you'll come up with different ways of interpreting this moment. The consciousness is the same. Not my consciousness is has LP Semedo written on it and is unique to me. But LP Semedo is a perception that generally I respond to or react to. Or me sitting on the high seat here, you know, being the master, the meditation teacher and so forth is, you know, this is the conventional position, the vipaka gum of my life. And then I'm on the high seat. But then if I identify it with, in terms of I'm LP Semedo, meditation master and all that, and you're my students. Well, that's coming out of attachment to the convention. But if I no longer interested in that convention, you know, I'm willing to, the vipaka kamma is like this, this role, this position I'm in is due to the kamma. So then it's not taken as some kind of personal acquisition or way of holding myself, but recognizing it for what it really is. And then each one of you with your different feelings, emotional reactions, physical conditions, whatever they might be, this is the vipaka kamma. So our relationship to it now is welcoming, accepting, opening to the vipaka kamma rather than identifying, trying to control it, get rid of it if you don't like it, trying to hold on to it if you like it. So then the meditation, it is this simple act of faith, open awareness, attention, using the conditions that are obvious, the body, the breath, the sensations, being able to, even your emotional state, or sound of silence, the space in the temple, the space, the silence. These are all here and now. And even when you leave the temple, there's still space wherever you go. Even if you're in a little room, there's space in the room. And space in the room is in the space. So our way of opening includes. It's an inclusive rather than an excluding one. So when we trust in this, then we begin to notice things as they are. So we can investigate the body or the contemplate the breath or whatever. But it's coming from no longer from some kind of personal attitude about it or identity, but using the way it is, willing to allow and let this moment be the way it is, physically, mentally, emotionally. And trusting that. And even the desire to change it or struggle, allow even the struggle to be the way it is. Or the boredom or the despair or the compulsive sense of the compulsive willful habits that we bring to meditation. Not trying to get rid of them and say you shouldn't have compulsive, you shouldn't be willful and give you suggestions like that, but recognizing that this kind of compulsive need to do something is like this, the way it is. So that's I hope that this evening's reflection will benefit you, and so that you know this seems to be a very auspicious winter's retreat with a fine group of monks and nuns here and Anagarikas, Anagarikas, and wonderful lay support, and on and on like this. The feels very good. I feel very good, very happy to be able to be with you at this time. So this evening is, even though it's one part, I'm not encouraging you to sit up till midnight, but because I'd like to start at 5 in the morning, as usual, and then during this time to just see, recognize how you do hold this. Whatever way, positive or negatively is not the issue. But you're trusting in your ability to open to it and recognize, realize the way it is. And accept the conditions that you're experiencing as they are rather than struggling against them. Is there anything I should? Oh, yeah. Yes. So we can say start at 8:30. After breakfast, there's puja at 5, and then 8:30. Then during this time also, in terms of silence and, the way we can hold noble silence can be a real tyrannical form of tyranny. So, I've been on retreats where people go around checking on you, shh, you're not supposed to talk, that kind of thing. And this is, where this is, this I find, is like treating you like a bunch of school children. And, so this way we hold the idea of noble silence and can be, don't you, those people are talking, they shouldn't, we can get ourselves into a real twist around that. To recognize that the silence is encouraged. It's a noble silence and not a tyrannical one or an obsessive grasping of silence. So, and we're all taking responsibility for how we live in this community. So I trust you all to use the satipanya rather than have a police force going around trying to keep everyone in control. And this is something when if I'm trusted and treated as an adult, I tend to rise up to that level. And if somebody starts browbeating me and telling me and trying to control me, I tend to sink into that level. So, the life in the Sangha is a beautiful life in which we're taking responsibility for our lives, for how we live, for what we say and do. And so we trust each other, to have this sense of trust and respect rather than endless demands on how we should behave and what we should or shouldn't do. And to me this resonates as something. Then I find people rise up when they're encouraged to. And in ways that even surprise. You're used to being, ordered about and controlled. Then sometimes we feel safe when there's a strong, teacher who really has his eyes on everybody and checking them out all the time and gets around to seeing what's going on in the common room. And the nuns behind, what are they doing over there? And what a kind of intercom or a kind of this tape, to see if they're talking about things they shouldn't, or have a spy system set up. We can have meetings in the after breakfast and say, who's the loose cannon in this community? Who have we got to put in their place, discipline, tie down, lock up? That's a police state. But recognize the beauty of our life is this encouragement or the awareness, wisdom, that we can never fully recognize if we're always treated as if we're little children and irresponsible and need to be controlled.